We're going to pick up where we left off, probably a little bit shorter this time than last week, and because I want to spend a lot of time talking about application. We're starting 1 Chronicles chapter 2. Might take some time this morning and do a little bit more applying what we read. 1 Chronicles chapter 2. Again, we're going to look at David's family just kind of as a reminder, because these people are going to be coming up over and over again as we read. 1 Chronicles chapter 2 and verse 13. Jesse begot his firstborn, Eliab, Abinadab the second, Shema the third, Nethaneel the fourth, Radai the fifth, Ozan the sixth, David the seventh, whose sisters were Zariah and Abigail, and the sons of Zariah, Abishai, Joab, Azahel, three. And then verse 17, this is something that won't come up for a little while. And Abigail bare Amasa. What we're going to see is throughout David's life, there's some controversy with Absalom. There's some controversy with different people being leaders of the army. And Joab begins to kill each one of them. He ends up killing Amasa. And we just go, oh, he killed Amasa. Amasa was his first cousin that he killed. Okay, that you need to let, you know, these are David's nephews that he is putting in charge of the military. Part of the reason that you find the kingdom splitting under Rehoboam is because there have been long-standing tensions within the nation of Israel. And David does nothing to stop this by giving all of these positions to family members. And you'll find that on the counting of the military, it's always the soldiers of Israel and the soldiers of Judah, long before the kingdom ever splits. So these tensions kind of develop and boil over time. Now with that, go back to 2 Samuel chapter 2. We're going to look how David secures the kingdom. 2 Samuel chapter 2. Saul is now dead. And we're going to see how God gives the kingdom to David. We looked last time about a lot of the background of how God had put David in the most perfect position to become king, how he became a national hero through the killing of Goliath, how he was Saul's armor bearer, how he was in the palace playing the harp for Saul, so he would have learned all of those things, knew everyone there, how Saul made him a general trying to get him killed, but not only made Saul more prominent and more liked. When David is running for his life, Saul kills all the priests, and the one remaining priest comes to David for protection. So now David has the priesthood, the military likes him, all the people in the palace like him. He's also the king's son-in-law, which makes him one of those in direct succession to the throne. That's going to be something we're going to look at today. But then as he's running in exile, we find that all those who are in debt, all those who are in trouble, they come to David. So David is really securing the hopes and dreams of everyone in the kingdom. He has the popular vote from literally every group of people. We looked, let's see here. Let's go to chapter 2, verse 4, and we'll look at another group of people that David is going to get their support. So chapter 2 of 2 Samuel, verse 4. The men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. Before we go any further, why would the men of Judah want to anoint David king? Because he's from their tribe. What did Saul do with all the men of Benjamin? Well, they're his relatives, his close relatives are from his tribe. They were the ones that got all of the military promotions. They're the ones that got all the cushy government jobs. Many of them would get tax breaks because they were his family members. What is the word where you put family members in positions because of your family members? Nepotism. That's what's going on here. Okay? If David is king, you know who's going to get a tax break? His nephew. His cousin. Okay? There's going to be a new general. Well, guess what? If you're from the tribe of Judah, you're first in line. So the men of Judah go, hey, okay, the men of Benjamin have been getting all the government benefits. Well, Saul's dead. If we make David king, now all of us get all the government benefits. We get the cushy jobs. We get the tax breaks. We get the promotions. We get all those things. So the men of Judah are the first. They want David to be king. They told David, saying, the men of Jabesh-Gilead were they that buried Saul. Okay, the men of Jabesh-Gilead, if you remember,
These were the people where the Benjamites stole their wives from, or they came and they slaughtered everybody and they took the virgins for wives for the men of Benjamin. So these are the relatives of Saul. If you remember, they were out in the outpost, and when the king came, came to invade them and said, "Well, I'll make you my servants, but I'll pluck your eyes out first." And remember, Saul came to their defense. These are Saul's biggest supporters. If anybody is going to oppose David being king and want one of Saul's direct sons to be king, it's the men of Jabesh-Gilead. When Saul is dead, the Philistines take his body and they strip all the armor off of it and they hang it on the city wall. And the men of Jabesh-Gilead risk their lives to go and get Saul's body and give it a proper burial. They tell David this. So David, verse 5, sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead and said unto them, "Blessed be you of the Lord that you have shown this kindness to your Lord, even to Saul, and have buried him." Notice the wisdom that David has. These are Saul's biggest supporters. Why? Well, one, they're related to him. Two, they have both their eyeballs, thanks to Saul. Okay. Otherwise, they would have lost an eye and be slaves to a foreign nation. So he goes and says, "I am so, so happy for what you did in honoring Saul and giving him a proper burial." What he's showing here is that he had no ill intention towards Saul, that he is grieving Saul's death, because remember, Saul has been trying to turn the whole nation against David, that David's this usurper trying to take my kingdom. Here, David is showing the exact opposite. Right? Then in verse 6, he says, "Now the Lord show kindness and truth to you, and I also will pay you back this kindness because you've done this thing." He said, "I want God to bless you because of what you did and giving Saul a proper burial. And I personally want to bless you for what you have done." You can see the wisdom that David has here. Verse 7, "Now therefore let your hands be strengthened, be valiant, for your master Saul is dead, and also the house of Judah have anointed me king over them. And I am now king, and I am in the position to bless you. I am in the position to protect you. And I want that opportunity to do so." You can see the wisdom here as he begins to consolidate the popular approval of everyone around him. Verse 17 of chapter 2. Okay, Saul has one son left named Ishbosheth. Ishbosheth is anointed king by Abner. Why would you want Ishbosheth to be king if you're Abner? Well, because you are the general of the army. You're in a very popular, cushy, powerful position. And do you think the king from Judah is going to give the guy from Benjamin the same position? No, this has nothing to do with what's best for the kingdom. This has to do with what's best for me. So Abner gets together with Ishbosheth, the men of Benjamin there. And so now there is going to be a civil war between those who follow Ishbosheth and those who follow David. So verse 17, "There was a very sore battle that day. Abner was beaten and the men of Israel before the servants of David. There were three sons of Zariah there." Okay, Zariah is David's sister. "Joab, Abishai, Azahel." Okay, these are David's nephew. "Azahel was as light of foot as a wild roe." In other words, he could run as fast as a deer. "And Azahel pursued after Abner, and the going turned not to the right hand nor to the left from following Abner." Why would he want to go and kill Abner? You want a quick end to the war? Cut off the head of the snake. Also, if you want to get promoted in David's new kingdom, bring back Abner's head. Okay, this is a move on Azahel's part. "So Abner looked behind him and he said, 'Are you Azahel?'" Okay, remember, this is a civil war among a family. All the nation of Israel and Judah, they're all related. They all know each other. They all are relatives. They're all just family members. "And he answered, 'I am.' Abner said to him, 'Turn aside to the right hand or the left.'" Find somebody else to fight. Okay, "lay hold on one of the young men and take his armor." Okay, he's not wearing armor because he's trying to chase him down and catch him. "But Azahel would not turn aside from following him. Abner said again to Azahel, 'Turn aside from following me. Why should I kill you to the ground or smite you to the ground? How would I hold up my face to Joab, your brother?'" He said, "Azahel, quit following me. I'm going to have to fight you and I'm going to kill you. And if I kill you, I'm going to take your brother off." Right? "Howbeit, Azahel refused to turn aside, wherefore Abner, with the hinder end of the spear, smote him under the fifth rib." Okay, this is what is supposed to be a nice move on Abner's part. Instead of taking the head, the sharp metal part of the spear, he takes the blunt, rounded end of the spear and tries to hit him in the stomach to knock the wind out of him, knock him down, so he'll quit following him. He's not trying to kill him. He's trying to stop him from following him because he doesn't want to kill him. Well, he happens to hit him a little too hard, and the spear, the back end of the spear, goes through his stomach, okay, killing him. Hey, that's a pretty hard hit with the back end of a spear. So he kills him, and Azahel falls down and dies. Joab also and Abishai pursued after Abner. The sun went down when they were come to the hill of Ammah that lies before Giah on the way of the wilderness of Gibeon. And the children of Benjamin, let's see where we are. Okay. The children of Benjamin gathered themselves together after Abner became one troop and stood on the top of the hill. Then Abner called to Joab and said, "Shall the sword devour forever? Know not that it will be bitterness in the latter end. How long will it be then ere you bid the people return from following the brethren?" And that's the end of the first part of the war. Okay. People died. They say, wait a minute, let's stop this nonsense. We're just killing each other. Let's try to take this a different route. So Azahel dies. A few other people get hurt and die. But Azahel is the main one we need to remember, because this is going to come back later with Joab. And this is, by the way, is going to go all the way even to Solomon's reign, what Joab does. Okay? So now chapter 3 and verse 12. What happens in chapter 3 is Abner is sexually immoral with one of Saul's concubines. And this ticks off Ishbosheth. By the way, you're going to see the same thing happen when Solomon becomes king. We just read it as sexual immorality and we just scoop on. We just go, okay, whatever. Why on earth would he be so ticked? Let this sink in. A concubine would be one of the king's wives. If you marry one of the king's wives, what does that make you? Well, if you marry the queen, you're king. So here, Abner, okay, we look at it as, he's just having a one-night stand with this woman. Ishbosheth is already fighting for his life and fighting for his kingdom, and he goes, wait a minute, maybe the general here is trying to usurp me, marry my stepmom, and become king. So he has this big falling out with Abner. I can't believe you do this to me. By the way, the same thing is going to happen with Solomon. If you remember when, and we'll look at this eventually, Solomon, Bathsheba comes, and Adonijah, who was anointed king and wanted to be king, but David said, no, it's going to be Solomon. Adonijah wants to marry Abishag, who was the young lady that helped take care of David when David was old. And Bathsheba comes and says, hey, can Adonijah marry Abishag? And Solomon gets ticked and says he's going to die for this. You're like, so the guy wants to marry a single girl. What's wrong with that? Well, because the appearance would be, when you marry the queen, guess what you become? You become king. Okay, that's why David gets upset. That's why Ishbosheth gets upset here. So Abner now turns coat. Okay? Verse 12. Abner sent messengers to David on his behalf, saying, whose is this land? Saying also, make your league with me, and behold, my hand will be with you to bring about all Israel to you. Okay. Abner says, hey, David, you already got the priesthood. You got most of the army. You got all the poor and the indebted people. Okay, you've got all the tribe of Judah. You've got all of these people. You got the men of Jabesh Gilead. You've got all of this support. But what you're missing is the last couple people of Israel. I'm the general. I'm the head of the army. Why don't we get together and work something out? Okay. In essence, he's offering to bring peace to the end of the war, give David the kingdom, and also he's kind of betraying Ishbosheth at the same time. Now, David has no ill will towards Ishbosheth. He wants to be king because God has anointed him king, and he wants there to be an end of the war. This would be a tremendous opportunity because Ishbosheth would no longer have an army. If Abner gets on David's side, he brings the whole army with him, and Ishbosheth is left literally by himself. So this is a great move for David to meet with Abner to bring about the end of the war. Verse 13. He said, well, I will make a league with you, but one thing I require of you, that is, you shall not see my face except you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face. Why on earth would David, who has all these other women as wives, want Michal? Because she is his legitimate claim to the throne. Because if he's married to her, which he was, but Saul ended that marriage and Saul married her off to somebody else, he's the king's son-in-law, and he is a direct heir to the throne. Because all of Saul's sons are dead, except for one, and that's Ishbosheth. And so this is his legitimate claim to the throne, would be Michael. So let's see here. Let's go down verse 15. Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband, even from Phaltiel, the son of Laish, and her husband went with her along weeping behind to Bahurim. Then said Abner to him, go return, and he returned. Okay, they go and they break up another marriage to bring Michael. But, I mean, Michael was obviously David's wife first until Saul messed all that up. Because remember, Saul didn't really care about Michael marrying David. He just wanted to use Michael to get David killed. But I want you to understand why all this stuff's happening. Because we just kind of read this and go, that's weird, and keep reading. Okay, there's a reason behind this. Verse 17. Abner had communication with the elders of Israel saying, you sought for David in times past to be king over you. Hey, you remember David, how he killed Goliath, how he brought all these victories? You said, man, this guy's going to make a great king. Okay, well, now do it. For the Lord has spoken to David, saying, by the hand of my servant David, I'll save my people Israel out of the hand of the Philistines and out of the hand of all their enemies. Abner also spoke in the ears of Benjamin. Why would he need to speak in the ears of Benjamin? Who's the number one supporter of Ishbosheth? The tribe of Benjamin. Okay. And Abner went also to speak in the ears of David in Hebron, all that seemed good to Israel and that seemed good to the whole house of Benjamin. So he got all of them. He got all of their information. Well, if David's king, well, he would do this. If David's king, well, this happened to us. Well, what's going to happen to us if David becomes king? So he gets all of the information, all of the questions, and all of the terms from the remaining people of Israel, and now betrays Ishbosheth and goes to David. Okay? So Abner came to David to Hebron, and 20 men with him, and David made Abner and the men that were with him a feast. Abner said to David, I will arise and go and will gather all Israel to my lord the king, that they may make a league with you, and that you may reign over all that your heart desires. David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. But you're in a civil war. The general for the other army comes and says, you know what? I can bring about the whole war to a close without a single bit of bloodshed. It's great, right? I mean, we don't want innocent people to die, especially when these innocent people are literally your family members. Okay? So he sends him away in peace. And behold, the servants of David and Joab came from pursuing a troop. They were out at a little skirmish, and they brought in great spoil with them. But Abner was not with David in Hebron, for he'd sent him away, and he was gone in peace. When Joab and all the host that was come with him were come, they told Joab, saying, Abner the son of Ner came to the king, and he has sent him away, and he is gone in peace. Joab came to the king and said, what have you done? Behold, Abner came to you. Why is it you sent him away, and he is quite gone? You know Abner, the son of Ner, that he came to deceive you, and to know you're going out and you're coming in, and know all that you do. Now, Joab gets ticked because Abner was sent away. And he goes, oh, don't you know he was trying to deceive you, and he was trying to trick you? Why on earth would Joab think that about Abner? Because he killed his brother. Is that the truth? No. But what happened when you refuse to forgive, when you become bitter, and when you become angry, and you become hateful towards an individual, guess what you do? You color all of their motives through the lens of your hatred and hurt. You can see this in politics. For whatever party you are, the other party, they can do no right. Okay, that is just the way it is. Whenever you, I don't know if you've ever seen a nasty divorce. The other, you know, the ex-husband could come and he could give the wife $1 million and she'd go, there's a reason you're doing this. You're just trying to be mean to me. No matter what you try to do, when someone refuses to forgive, they're going to color it all in a wrong way. And this is something we need to remember because we have a tendency in our bitterness and refusal to forgive those who've hurt us to malign everything they do. They can do no right in our sights. One of the most amazing passages of Scripture to me is Joseph's brothers. They hated Joseph. You know what it says? They could not speak kindly to him. They hated him so much they could not physically open their mouth to say something kind about him. But I see many people who go through hard times, somebody hurts them, somebody wrongs them, and they cannot get over it. And it colors their perspective of everything they do. That's the way Joab is towards Abner. Now, let me ask you. Was Abner trying to kill Asahel? No. Was this a where he broke in and murdered him? No. This was war. Asahel What do you think he was trying to do? He was trying to kill Abner. Okay? This is war. That happens. Abner is the one who tried to bring about peace at the end of the day. Abner's still trying to bring about peace. But Joab only knows one thing, and that's kill people. And you're going to see this. He's going to kill his own cousin. He's going to kill all kinds of people. Because he is just an angry, hateful, bitter man. Because he cannot forgive what other people do to him. You compare Joab, by the way, to David. What about David as it relates to Saul? I mean, look at the way he was towards the men of Jabesh-Gilead. After Saul has pursued you and tried to kill you, wouldn't you want his body rotten on the wall of the enemy? No, he says, no, I want him buried with honor. Okay? So you can see just a comparison and contrast, again, between the flesh and the spirit. David being obviously a picture of Jesus Christ and what a life lived in the spirit was supposed to look like. Okay, let's keep reading. Verse 26. When Joab was come out from David, he sent messengers after Abner, which brought him again from the well of Sirah, but David did not know it. When Abner was returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside to the gate to speak with him quietly, smote him there under the fifth rib, that he died for the blood of Asahel, his brother. Now, Joab murdered Abner. There is no other word for this. He says, hey man, I'm going to talk to you. Pulls out a knife, sticks him in the gut. Did Abner murder Asahel? No. One, it was an accident. He was just trying to knock him down. Two, he was in self-defense from a man trying to kill him. Three, it's war. Okay, Joab commits murder, whereas Abner, it was a casualty of war, self-defense, somebody trying to kill him. Okay. Verse 28, afterward, when David heard it, he said, I and my kingdom are guiltless before the Lord forever from the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. Let it rest on the head of Joab and all his father's house, and let there not fail from the house of Joab one that has an issue, or that is a leper, or that leans on a staff, or that falls on the sword, or that lacks bread. He places a curse on Joab's whole family. Why would he do this? Well, is David's kingdom firmly established? No. It's very precarious. Okay. Do they have cell phones and secret recordings and video cameras? No. The only thing they have is word of mouth. What do you think the people of Benjamin are going to hear? Abner went to see David with a white flag to arrange a peaceful end to this conflict, and David had Joab kill him in cold blood. Okay, so David has got to combat that rumor and has to show that he is a man who would honor a peaceful exchange here. He's a man who would not be seeking to kill Abner, but this was not his desire, and so he does so by cursing Joab, and he removes Joab from being the head of the army, okay, which we'll look at later. So Joab and Abishai, his brother, slew Abner because he'd slain their brother Asahel at Gibeon in the battle. David said to Joab and to all the people that were with him, rend your clothes, gird you a sackcloth, and mourn before Abner, and David himself followed the body. Okay, he wants Abner buried with military honors, and he wants to be the first person people see at the funeral. Why? Because this could go south in a hurry. You already got people, this civil war here lasts for like 7.5 years. You already got people who were tired of the fighting, who want it to be over, who want to see a peaceful end, and Abner being killed could blow the whole thing up. They buried Abner in Hebron, and the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner, and all the people wept. And the king lamented over Abner and said, "Did Abner died Abner as a fool dies? Your hands were not bound, your feet not put in fetters. As a man falls before wicked men, so you fell." And all the people wept again over him. Notice what he's doing here. He's making it very clear that he had no desire for Abner to die. That this was not his desire, and that Joab is now a cursed, wicked murderer. Okay? Now, what should David have done to a murderer? He should have executed him. Why doesn't he? Because that's his nephew. Right? Now, do you see why later on, what is one of David's big problems? He can't contract his family members. He won't correct his sons. He won't tell them no. He won't do justice when it comes to Absalom. Okay? What you see is that David has a weak spot, and that is he won't correct his family members. He won't do justice towards his family members, which, by the way, is a tremendous lesson for us. It is amazing how many people will not correct their own children. It is. It's appalling. That if your child did this, then your child's a pervert. If my child does it, my child misunderstood. If your child does it, they need the harshest sentence allowable under law. If my child does it, they need leniency. Okay? We all struggle with that. And we have to look and see what is going to happen with Absalom. Okay, is a result of David's sin, obviously, with Bathsheba. But it has its roots way far back, to where David will execute justice on the guy that killed Saul, but won't execute justice on the man who kills Abner. Why? Because it's his nephew. Okay, we need to be very careful. In the book of, I think it's Malachi, it talks about justices, judges perverting justice, and it uses a phrase about being partial. In the Hebrew, the word partial means to look at the face. In other words, before they declare something to be right or wrong, they see who did it. Okay? That is very, very prevalent in our society today. A politician, was he a Republican or a Democrat? Then I'll tell you whether it's wrong. That's the society in which we live. Because one politician committing adultery will hang them high. Another politician committing adultery will defend them. Adultery is adultery. Lying's lying. Sin is sin. What we're going to look at later on in the morning worship service when we look at Amos is it's time for judgment to begin at the house of God. Paul very emphatically teaches in 1 Corinthians that he doesn't judge people outside the church, he judges people inside the church. Why on earth are you getting the speck out of your brother's eye? Deal with the beam in your own. David, why are you dealing with all these other murderers, the guy who murders Saul, and we're going to see the guy who murders Ishbosheth, but the guy who murders Abner? No justice. Okay? And this is something we've got to really examine our own hearts, because we can be very partial as it relates to what is right and wrong. And normally the people we give the biggest pass to are our own family members. Okay? Keep reading. Let's see here. So the king weeps in verse 36. All the people took notice of it. Notice of what? That David is weeping there at the tomb of Abner. And it pleased them, as whatsoever the king did pleased all the people. For all the people and all Israel understood that day that it was not of the king to kill Abner, the son of Ner. Okay, so notice what he does. He's made it very clear this was not my idea. Verse 38, the king said to his servants, know you not that there is a prince and a great man fallen this day in Israel? Now notice verse 39. I am this day weak, though anointed king, and these men, the sons of Zeruiah, are too hard for me. You know, it's just too much. I could lose the kingdom if I execute justice. Okay? Again, this is a very pragmatic thought by David. He's not concerned about what is right. He's not concerned about innocent blood. He's more concerned of, you know what, these two nephews of mine, you know what, I really don't know if I can tell them no. Because that's kind of a difficult situation I'm in. So the Lord will reward the doer of evil according to his wickedness. By the way, David never executes justice on Joab. He leaves it to his son to do it, which is a pretty cowardly thing to do. He leaves it to Solomon to execute justice. All right, chapter 4, verse 5. The sons of Rimmon, the Beerothite, Rechab and Baana, went and came to the heat of the day to the house of Ishbosheth, who lay on a bed at noon. And they came there in the midst of the house as though they would have fetched wheat, and they smote him under the fifth rib, and Rechab and Baana, his brother, escaped. For when they came to the house, he lay on his bed in his bedchamber, and they smote him, slew him, and beheaded him, and took his head, and got them away through the plain all night. They brought the head of Ishbosheth to David to Hebron, and said to the king, behold the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy. which sought your life. And the Lord has avenged my lord, the king this day of Saul and of his seed. Okay? Now, these people obviously haven't been paying attention to David and David's desire to have a peaceful transfer of power from Saul's family to his own. What happened to the guy who killed Saul? Killed him. You don't touch the king. These guys go and they kill a man while he's sleeping. Okay, that's what you call murder. They behead him and they run to David with the head of the king, right, of Ishbosheth, because they think David is now going to reward them and promote them because they brought about the end of everything and now he can be king. Okay, verse 9. David answered Rechab and Bana, his brother, the sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, and said to them, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my soul out of all adversity, notice who he gives the credit for. He gives all the credit to the Lord. Who, again, I want you to see the hand of God in all this. This is, we can look and say, oh, David was wise. Let's be wise like David. No, this is not about David's wisdom. This is the Lord putting David in the king's palace. This is the Lord defeating Goliath through David. This is the Lord bringing all the people to him. This is the Lord that is doing all of these things, giving him wisdom and giving him all the support. The Lord is the one who's put him in this position. Okay? He said, as the Lord lives, who redeemed my soul of all adversity, when one told me, saying, behold, Saul is dead, thinking to have brought good tidings, I took hold of him and slew him in Ziklag, who thought I would have given him a reward for his tidings. How much more, when wicked men have slain a righteous person in his own house upon his bed, shall I not therefore require his blood out of your hand and take you away from the earth? David commanded his young men. They slew them, cut off their hands and their feet, and hung them over the pool in Hebron. And they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in the sepulcher of Abner in Hebron. So what you have here is David again is emphasizing over and over and over again, don't touch the king, don't touch the king, don't touch the king, don't touch the king. Now, on one hand, that's because this is a principle that is true and that is right. On another hand, guess who's now king? You want to make it very clear that attempt on the king's life means you're dead. Now, you can kill Abner, and that's okay, but you can't touch the king. Okay? Chapter 5, verse 3. So all the elders of Israel came to the king to Hebron. And King David made a league with them in Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. Notice that David enters into an agreement with them. This is what Abner had worked to bring about. Okay, this is not, Ishbosheth's king, let's go be, let's go follow David. This has been a civil war for 7.5 years where you're trying to get rid of David so Ishbosheth can be king. Wouldn't you be worried now that Ishbosheth is dead about some retaliation? Wouldn't you want some type of guarantee that you're not all going to be hung as traitors the next day? I mean, this happens. Okay? If there was a civil war and you were trying to overthrow the king or the president or whoever it would be, you would want some guarantee that if you stop the fighting, that he would not have you beheaded, executed, etc. So David enters in this agreement with the leaders of Israel. And David, verse 4, is 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigns for 40 years. And Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and Jerusalem, he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah. Just a thought here. He becomes king at 30 years old. He runs from Saul for most of his 20s. I meet many people who, in their 20s, say, oh no, God's abandoned me, he's never going to use me. I'm 16 years old and I don't have a girlfriend. I'm never going to get married. Okay? That's the attitude some people have. I'm 28 years old and I'm still in school. Okay? Remember, Jesus didn't start his ministry till he was 30 years old. I don't think that we could look at Jesus and go, man, he got a late start in life. What a failure. David is the greatest king that has ever lived. And he waited for many years. He was anointed king when he was probably 12 or 13 years old. And so he's waiting 15, 16, 17, 18 years to become king. Tremendous lesson in patience, trusting that the Lord, what he has promised, he will do. to not get in a hurry, because David could have become king very quickly. He had opportunities to kill Saul. He had many opportunities. But he didn't operate in the flesh. Okay? He let things go according to the Lord's plan, the Lord's timing. And that's a great lesson for us. I am not a patient person. And I don't know that I've ever really met a patient person. The only people I've met that are patient are people who literally had their patience beat into them by the Lord. Because their whole life, God made them patient. It's a good lesson for us. We sometimes look at things and we say, well, God, you said you'd do this. Why haven't you done it now? You don't think David thought that when Saul was chasing him all over the wilderness? When he was going to the Philistines? You don't thought, when he had the opportunities over and over again to kill Saul? Don't you think it was going through his mind, maybe this is what God wants me to do? God has already told me I'm going to be king. You know what? Maybe if I just kill him, I'll bring about God's will faster. Be patient. The Lord will bring things about in his timing. We have to be very patient, trust the Lord, be faithful, and God will bring it about. Chapter 5, verse 10. David went on and grew great, and the Lord God of hosts was with him. Why was David a great king? Because of God and his grace. It's very easy to read the Old Testament through the lens of character development. And please hear me all the way out on this. There is nothing wrong with teaching character and emphasizing character. But the whole of Scripture is that the only way you can have Christian character is through the regenerating work of the Holy Spirit through an act of God's grace. And to try to teach someone character apart from the Spirit of God is a waste of time. To try to instill morality in an unregenerate person is a waste of time. We have to point people to the grace that is found in Jesus Christ's death, burial, and resurrection. To the regenerative work, the power that raised him from the dead, that can come and quicken their mortal bodies, can raise them from the dead and cause them to walk in his ways. One of the big dangers of reading the Old Testament is we say, you should be like David. No. You need Jesus Christ. David was who he was because of God's grace. And one of the tremendous dangers is we can read about Daniel, and we can read about Ezekiel, and we can read about Joseph, and we can read about David and Solomon and all of those things. That you need to be like them. You need to be like them. But the whole purpose of the law is to show you you need a Savior, because you can't be what God requires of you. So we need to make sure that when we're reading this, we understand that David is king not because of David, but because of God. That the reason he is so wise in all the decisions he's made is because God has imparted the wisdom to him. And the reason that all of these people are supporting him and he's made all these good decisions is not because he was such a wise, smart person, but because of God's grace in his life. If we are not careful, we can become a bunch of people who preach law and never once tell people it's the Spirit of God that enables you to live out God's commands. Okay, we have to make sure that we understand the Old Covenant and the New Covenant. The Old Covenant is given to say, you know what? You can't do these things. The New Covenant is given to show you that Jesus Christ and his grace and the power of the Spirit can raise you from the dead and conform you to the image of Christ, so that you are now able, by the power of the Spirit, to do these things. Okay, and we need to be careful as we raise our kids to always point them to Jesus, to use the law as it was meant to. Because if we're not careful, we can instill morality in children without ever instilling with them the power of the Spirit that can make them moral. Okay? To tell a kid to stop lying, the reason that's in the Ten Commandments is to show them they can't stop lying and they need someone to change them. They need someone to deliver them. So when we look at David, we don't want to see David. We want to see the grace of God in David's life. To understand not that you can be like David too if you will just fast and pray. No, God in his grace can bring about his will in your life if you will trust him and you will follow him and you will patiently obey him. God in his grace can do the same thing in your life. Verse 12. David perceived that the Lord had established a king over all Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for his people Israel's sake. What was Saul's concern when he was fighting the Philistines and he made that vow, no one can touch any food until all the Philistines are dead? What was it that I may be avenged on my enemies? Who was Saul concerned with?
Himself.
David is now king, and where is his concern?
Others.
Okay. One of the greatest understandings of Christianity is Christianity is about God and his glory and the good of your fellow man. It is not about you. Jesus taught this in the two greatest commandments. Love God, love your neighbor. Where are you? Well, you're there to love God and you're there to love your neighbor. Okay? This is the essence of Christianity. That when God puts you in a position, you are there for his glory, the Lord did this, and for the good of other people. Way too often we talk about self-serving politicians. We are self-serving. Why do we want the raise? Why do we want the promotion? Why do we want the job? Why do we want this? Why do we want that? Why do we want this? Why do we want that? For ourselves. So that we feel better about ourselves, so that we have more. Very rarely do you find someone who is seeking to be king so that he can benefit all of God's people. Right? That is what we learn from Jesus, is that Jesus comes not for himself, but for the people of God. And when we talk about elders and we talk about deacons, one of the things we always talk about is it's the upside down pyramid. That to become an elder is to serve more. To become a deacon is to serve more, not be served. Because the greatest is the least. And the one who is first is last. And that's what we learn from Jesus. And that is to seek the benefit of others for the glory of God. Okay, next week we're going to look at David's sin. And depending on how far we get, we'll probably get into Absalom. And all that, but is there any comments or questions or insights that y'all had as we went over this today?
I have a question.
Yeah.
All right, so David was married to Michael. Saul did away with that. She married another man, obviously, that adored her.
Yeah.
He followed her weeping. And David said, bring me my wife. Okay, so that's a very vivid picture. I was trained by my mother, two wrongs don't make a right. All right. Now I'm thinking about it in my business. If I see wrongs that have happened over the years, that to go back and fix those sometimes is messy. And even in life.
Yeah.
Do two wrongs make a right sometimes? Because that's exactly what's happened there. Now, was she his wife? She was.
Yeah.
But it's obvious that she had another husband that loved her. He's messing that up.
Yeah. I think the question, the way I would word it is this.
Yeah, so what does Scripture say, I guess, is my question.
This is the age-old question, okay? And I won't get into illustrations of this, but this happens with multiple partners, divorce, remarriage, multiple kids, his, mine, ours. I'll give you one, okay? This real-life example. Of a guy who was divorced, had children, a woman who was divorced and had children. They decided to move in together, though they weren't married, though their other spouses were still there and there was hope for reconciliation between the other spouses. And then they decided to adopt a child together, even though they weren't married yet. And then they went to a pastor to ask him to marry them. What do you tell him? Well, you shouldn't be living together, and you should try to reconcile with your spouses, but they just adopted a kid together. The way I would put it is this. Whenever we sin, we take a rope and we tie a knot in it.
And every time we sin, we tie another knot, another knot, another knot, another knot, another knot. And eventually, what we have is we have this giant ball of knots. And I cannot tell you how to unwind it. That's something where you have to trust the Spirit. You have to pray. You have to seek the Lord for wisdom. I can tell you what God's Word says in specific instances. But when you get that far down the road of all of Saul's jealousy, that's why he wants them to get married, and it's arranged marriage because he wants to get him killed, and all. Once you've tied so many knots, there is no simple solution. Now, should Christians try to go make it right? Obviously. Part of being a Christian is you go try to make things right. But at a certain point in time, things are so messed up, you can't. And all you can do is go and ask for forgiveness. You can go and apologize, and you can do whatever you can to make it right. Was David right in this, wrong in this? I'm not God. The Bible doesn't tell us whether he was right or wrong. It's descriptive, not prescriptive. And remember that when you read the Old Testament. Yes. It's just telling you what happened. It's not telling you it's right or wrong. It's just telling you what happened. I would say that as a Christian, you try to make things right. Some situations, it can be messy. Some situations, you just can't. You know, the person that you wrong is dead. What do you do? Yeah. I would say the best illustration of this that I can think of in terms of the heart is there was a man who had an amazing testimony who came to the Lord. He was over in the UK. I get all those islands mixed up between Wales and Ireland and all that. He was from over there. So he got right with the Lord, had an amazing testimony, just miraculously saved, and his pastor was invited to come over to the United States on a preaching tour. And so he asked the man, "Would you come with me? Because I want you to come and give your testimony, because it would be very powerful, and many people come to know the Lord." And the man said, "I can't." He said, "Why not?" He said, "I can't afford to." He said, "What are you talking about? Your business is booming. You make so much money." And he said, "No, I don't make a dime." He said, "I don't understand. You have so much business." He said, "No, you don't understand. Before I came to know the Lord, when somebody bought a dozen flowers for me, I gave them 11. When somebody bought a pound of potatoes, I put my thumb on the scale and sold them 3/4 of a pound. He said, "There's no way I could possibly know how many people I cheated over the years." He said, "So now whenever somebody buys a dozen roses for me, I give them 13. Whenever somebody buys a pound of potatoes, I give them 1 1/4 pounds. I make no profit from my business, because I'm trying every way I can to restore what I stole from other people." You know, I think that's the right attitude. Can you really remember how many people you ripped off when you have a business practice like that? There is no way you could ever make it right. But in his heart was to follow the Lord, do right, and reconcile the way that Zacchaeus tried to. All right? Great question, though. I wish I could give you a better answer.
It's pretty good.
All right. Larry, can you close in prayer?